All right, welcome back. Here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report and continuing our focus on the resource sector, we are now chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, we're going to shift a little bit away from precious metals and talk about the nickel sector, because you sent us over a couple talking points here on some deals, some transactions that have happened in the nickel sector that helps, I think, in some investors put some value to some assets. And hey, deals in any commodities sector, in any sector broadly, are, I think, a positive. It frees up capital and it can help set values for other assets. Let's talk about this group called Appian Capital. Now, it's a group, I believe, based out of the UK. This group has made a couple deals recently, mostly in Brazil, selling some assets to a SPAC, ACG. Take us through a little background on some of these deals in Appian Capital, please.
That's right, and good to be with you, Corey and Shad, as always. I think this deal has gone a little bit under the radar, and I'll just say generally Appian is a private equity group based out of the UK, and they've made some pretty astute investments as of late in the resource space. The two assets that they sold to this SPAC, Santa Rita, which is a nickel and copper mine, as well as Serrote, which has gold and copper primarily. Both were bought in the 2018 timeframe, and you know they're selling it to the SPAC for $1 billion in cash. So it's likely they've made at least a 10x on this investment in roughly a five-year time span. So it's a good win for Appian. They actually have some extra kickers that come from this deal as well. They retain a 2.75% royalty at Santa Rita, and I know for sure that that will have some value down the line. We'll see how long they decide to keep that before monetizing it. And then they also, interestingly, have a claim, likely in the amount of around $200 million, against Sibanye-Stillwater. Listeners may remember about a year ago, they actually announced a deal for Santa Rita and Serrote as well with Sibanye-Stillwater with a $1.2 million price tag. Sibanye pulled out of the deal subsequently due to a quote-unquote seismic event that occurred at Santa Rita. Of course, the two parties dispute whether that was materially enough to dissolve the transaction. So it's potentially an additional, up to an additional couple hundred million could be coming into the coffers of Appian. So a good deal for them. But I think there are implications for this deal, beyond just Appian. Interestingly, coming into the SPAC, ACG are some major heavy hitters within the space. We have Glencore putting up $100 million out of the $1 billion that was raised to become the offtaker of choice for the Santa Rita nickel mine. And then PowerCo, which is Volkswagen's battery subsidiary, also put up $100 million for prepaid nickel offtake rights, also from Santa Rita. Stellantis put in $100 million as well. It's a little unclear how much nickel they're getting relative to Volkswagen. But it sounds like they will also be taking nickel directly from Santa Rita for their vehicles. So we've seen a major trading house and two major automakers come into this deal. And interestingly, I think this deal gives us a good look at what a offtake agreement at a late stage or producing nickel sulfide mine can look like. You know, between Glencore putting up $100 million and PowerCo putting up $100 million for their prepaid offtake rights, that's a $200 million price tag, basically, for Santa Rita's output. Maybe you could look at it more aggressively as $300 million, because Stellantis is putting in $100 million in equity. It's not clear how much nickel they'll be getting themselves, but we're talking around $200 or $300 million value for this near-term nickel supply. So I think that has a very interesting read-through for other late-stage nickel development projects that are out there. And as followers of the space know, late-stage nickel development assets are few and far in between. And of the ones that are out there, most already have off-takers locked in. You know, look at Tesla's deal with Talon Metals at Tamarack in Minnesota, or, BHP owns 60% of Kabanga, so they have that wrapped up. And, now Stellantis and Volkswagen of Glencore have come in for Santa Rita. It's interesting to look out there and see which nickel development plays don't have an offtake partner. One very topical piece of news, Centaurus Metals, also down in Brazil, they just got their offtake rights back from Vale, and they gave Vale a 1.2% royalty in exchange for their offtake rights back. Share price jumped, 15% or so on the back of that news. And, the size of Centaurus's Jaguar operation is around 20,000 tons per annum nickel sulfate and another 10,000 tons per annum mixed sulfide precipitate. For context, Santa Rita's production profile is around 20,000 tons per annum nickel. So you could argue Centaurus is, 50% larger or so. Another name, and this is one that we do own in the MJG portfolio, is Sama Resources. They actually just came out with an updated resource yesterday, and they more than doubled their resource. Their previous PEA, just for context, again, with a resource less than half the size than it currently is, saw them producing 13,000 tons per annum nickel and 14,000 tons per annum of copper concentrate. So that's a little bit smaller than either Santa Rita or what Centaurus is envisioning. But we'll see. They have an updated PEA coming out at the end of the year. I think it's possible with this, more than doubling of the resource, we'll see the throughput also expanded. So here are a couple, names that come to mind. Later stage sulfide development projects that don't yet have an offtaker with their hand up. And this could prove quite valuable for these companies because near-term nickel supply is clearly in demand.
Matt, I think you bring up some great points there as far as the nickel market. And a lot of the nickel that we saw going into production over the last decade was actually nickel laterites. But this nickel sulfide is obviously much more appropriate for the battery metals market and for the battery space. And speaking of Glencore and Sibanye, we just saw Glencore go in and take a strategic stake in Stillwater Critical Minerals for their nickel deposit right next to Sibanye in Montana, after Glencore had also taken out a strategic stake recently in Palladium One. So that's definitely right. Glencore is looking for nickel. And we've seen more and more interest in the space, but it's a small universe of stocks. And a lot of retail investors may not really be equipped to figure out, is this a good deposit? Is this something the majors will want? Is this something a battery company will partner with us for? Is this something a manufacturer of autos would want? How do you discern whether a nickel deposit is in fact the kind of deposit ahead of time before these deals are struck?
Sure. And just to add on to your point, Shad, also BHP is very honed in on the nickel space. You might have seen that they just announced, maybe this was last month, that their incubator program, which I think is quite innovative, I like what they're doing there, is their Explore Incubator program, is only accepting applicants focused on nickel or copper exploration, whereas their last cohort, lithium and a whole host of other critical minerals were considered. They're being very explicit. They're only interested in nickel and copper at the moment. And then BHP as well, just earlier this week, this acquisition flew a little under the radar. They paid $10 million to an Aussie group called Ragnar Metals for a earlier stage Scandinavian based nickel asset that BHP is now going to take forward on 100% basis. And it's exploration stage. This is not a late stage development project by any means. So it seems as if BHP is going to be exploring that one internally, which I found interesting. To your broader point, I mean, sulfides are very much in demand. And one of the other key reasons that wasn't mentioned is because of their CO2 emission profile. Again, it really depends if it's a higher grade or a lower grade sulfide. But for these higher grade sulfide projects compared to your average laterite, we're talking 50% less CO2 emission per unit of nickel created. So that's of particular importance to certain end users, and we will see premiums paid for companies that can produce nickel with low CO2 profiles. And so that's another added benefit. To your point, will the project work? You have to look at the grade, of course, for sulfides. You have to look at the deposit type. You have to look at scale. If it's a BHP type group that you want to come in, there has to be that exploration potential. There has to be that, at least the potential for district scale projects should things go to plan. However, for a company that's more focused on securing near-term nickel supply, they might be a little bit less interested in, you know, how this asset's going to look in 40 years and more, can we get nickel out of it in the next few years? And, you know, count on that, you know, for 10 years or so. So I think it's very case by case, even though each, you know, this is a unique dynamic amongst nickel developers. I try not to stray away from, you know, how I evaluate companies generally. And that starts with the people. You look at the asset, you know, you look at the company structure. So the asset's only one part of any investment decision that we'd make, you know, nickel or otherwise.
So these are very positive developments for the nickel space, having some of these bigger players and even some different groups taking part in funding and even taking over some of these assets. Matt, do you think this is still early stage for the nickel market here? Something almost similar to some of the other critical minerals like lithium that we could see even more money coming in. It could be a wave to ride for investors.
Potentially. Yeah, there are definitely risks on the horizon, though, when it comes to the nickel market generally. I mean, the amount of supply that's coming out of Indonesia, I think, has blown the minds of many in the industry. And, you know, it looks like some of these major Chinese groups are actually having success, you know, turning what was expected to be, you know, low quality nickel, you know, destined for the steel market, you know, converting it into nickel matte that can then be converted into battery grade material. So that's a risk. And then there's also risk of technology risk as well. The lithium iron phosphate battery cathode chemistry, LFP, as it's known in the industry, is gaining substantial market share. I think there's an argument to be made that, you know, by 2030, LFP will actually be the dominant lithium battery chemistry. If you look at all lithium battery applications globally, you know, if you're looking at electric vehicles in particular, we're probably going to see a bifurcation. And Tesla's already doing this. Volkswagen's put out an announcement where, you know, the highest quality EVs, where performance is desired, will use the ternary chemistry, which is, you know, your typical nickel, cobalt, manganese, potentially aluminum cathode chemistry, whereas the lower quality, or at least more base model vehicles, will have LFP. So that's also a potential, you know, longer term risk for nickel supply. That said, it's just the disparity between the amount of money and attention that is being given to lithium relative to nickel. Nickel's a much larger market. Nickel's a much more important market as far as I'm concerned. You know, if you look at all of its applications, it's nearly as important as lithium for batteries. So I think that there's plenty of opportunity amongst nickel. And we haven't seen much of a spillover. I have seen quite a bit of generalist interest in lithium, as you guys have. You know, there are new investors coming into the space left and right that haven't invested or thought about mining in a decade, if not ever, in their investment career. But I've yet to see major spillover to other critical minerals such as nickel, such as graphite, cobalt as well. So I do think we're still early days. Of course, the question is, in the meantime, or in the immediate term, is there going to be a major, you know, recession and hence demand shock? And there could be short-term pain ahead.
Well, Matt, another area of the market that you focus on, and I think it could tie back into nickel and into this critical minerals theme, is the royalty sector. As you noted, some of the royalty companies were involved in some of those latest transactions, trying to get a seat at the table. And we have seen, mostly in the royalty space, a focus initially a couple decades ago on oil and gas companies, and then for the last decade, really precious metals. But there are a few companies, just off the top of my mind, I can think of things like Altius Minerals or Ecora Resources or even Nova Royalty, has some limited nickel royalty exposure. Do you think that's an area of the business we may see expand in these critical minerals, is more royalty companies being developed or more royalty companies, even the larger companies, trying to get some of these critical mineral royalties in their basket or in their portfolios?
That's a good question. And that actually is something that's caught my eye just in the past few weeks, not just with nickel, but copper as well. We're seeing some interesting parties step up here in the royalty space, you know, for nickel or copper focused royalty assets. One example is just this morning. It was announced that a Cisco royalty is paying $15 million to ASX-listed Hot Chili for a 1% copper royalty, as well as a 3% gold royalty at Hot Chili's Costa Fuego copper asset down in Chile. So that's new to me. OR has largely steered clear from copper, but it looks like they're interested in adding copper exposure, as evidenced by this transaction. And then going back to the Appian ACG deal that we were talking about previously, Royal Gold actually comes out of this deal with some royalties. They do have a gold royalty over Serrote, but also, as you can see in the news release, they paid $35 million for copper and nickel royalties over Serrote, which is copper only in the case of that asset. And then at Santa Rita, they have a royalty over the nickel and copper produced there. So here are two parties, OR and Royal Gold, that maybe many folks weren't aware were interested in these critical minerals, making deals here in pretty short order. And, you know, the read through here, you know, you mentioned Nova. Nova is a holding of ours within the MJG fund as well. They actually announced right on the heels of the departure of their CEO, Alex Sukernik, that they had engaged PI Financial to run a strategic review. And so one would imagine that selling the company is an option that's on the table. It remains to be seen whether that's the direction the company goes. But if they do decide to go that route, perhaps OR and Royal Gold, you know, should be added to the list of potential suitors. And that's on top of names like Franco. We know Franco is very hungry for copper and actually have some very good development stage royalties within their portfolio. Interestingly, three of those overlap with Nova's portfolio at Taka Taka, Nueva Union, if I'm not mistaken, and Hudbay's Copper World project down in Arizona. You know, Triple Flag is another potential suitor. Horizon Copper, you mentioned Ecora, you mentioned Altius. You know, EMX, Elemental Altus, all of these groups come to mind. So I think the market for nickel and copper focused royalties is picking up. And, you know, to Nova's credit, 5 years ago, that was not the case. They were, you know, one of the few companies in town that were looking to pick up development stage copper or nickel focused royalties. I think it's clear to see that has changed. And over the past year or two, you've seen these much larger royalty groups really, really increase their interest in these non-gold focused royalties.
What about what you're doing within your portfolio over at MJG? Are you shifting a little bit more focus or allocating at least a little bit more money towards some of these critical mineral sectors?
Corey, you know my style. I do follow the weightings of specific metals within the MJG portfolio, just from a portfolio construction and risk perspective. But really, as I'm evaluating new investment opportunities, the very last thing I consider is the metal of focus. So I try not to get too caught up into, you know, metal price narratives. That said, you know I'm quite comfortable with copper. You know, it's our second largest metal by weighting within the MJG portfolio at around 20%. If a new copper focused deal, you know, cross my desk and it, you know, check the boxes of people, you know, asset quality, company structure, upcoming catalysts, a price to value metrics, you know, it was in a jurisdiction that we weren't already overly exposed to, then I'd happily add some more copper exposure. Nickel, yeah, we really only have one, you know, pure play nickel focused position. So, you know, in theory, if there's the right opportunity that crosses the desk, I wouldn't hesitate on that front. You know, steering clear from lithium for the foreseeable future, there's probably money to be made amongst the higher quality later stage development projects that actually have the potential to make it into production in the next few years. But there's just so much money, so much competition for investor attention, so much hype relative to these other minerals that I'd rather save my fire and look elsewhere. So maybe lithium's the one exception where I'm saying, you know, due to the what I view is too much hype and too much excitement relative to this metal, we're steering clear.
Well, Matt, just as we kind of look at the landscape and resource investing, for the most part, we've highlighted some of the standout points. But when you look at most of the sector, it's still very much in the doldrums as far as especially the junior mining stocks. And so some of the producers have gotten traction. Some of the royalty companies are doing okay. But when you talk to the average resource investor that may be diversified across precious metals, some of these battery metals and critical minerals, for the most part, people are down on the year or have had a rough go of it for some time now. What advice would you give them as someone that's been in the sector for a while? You've seen these cycles and commodities ebb and flow, and you've also seen times where it's a good time to accumulate and a good time to stay on the sidelines. How are you approaching managing your portfolio, and what advice would you have for investors going through kind of a tough slog?
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, there is a lot of pessimism. There's a lot of burnout amongst the junior space. And look, we're largely seeing that, you know, within the MJG portfolio as well. I will say that we have had a couple outperformers within the portfolio over the past 6 months. So this year hasn't been as rough from an MJG perspective. In fact, we're up on the year, but it's definitely been due to a couple outperformers and not a rising tide lift all boats scenario. Yeah, I think a big question is whether we can see the junior market, you know, take its next leg higher without the broader market rolling over first. You know, going back to the mid 1980s, we've had 7 major rate hike cycles. In 6 of them, actually, we've seen the market reach all-time highs subsequent to the pause. That's not my base case of what happens here, but it's within the realm of possibility. I do probably think that resource juniors catch a bid if we do see, you know, the broader market move towards and past all-time highs and folks continue to get more and more risk on. Again, that's not my base case, but I could see that happening. I think the other, you know, more likely scenario is we are witnessing a pretty long and pretty broad bear market rally, but that there's more pain to come in the second half of the year and that there's a broader market washout. While that's occurring, that will be painful for those in the resource space, but I think that would set the stage for the next move higher. You know, think of spring 2020, with the COVID washout, and then how quickly first the gold juniors rallied off of the bottom. But then, you know, the following year, the rest of the metals complex largely followed suit. So, you know, my recommendation would be for investors to assume the worst and, you know, plan their portfolio around that. I think it'd be foolish to exit the market entirely and to exit, you know, all of one's resource positions, but perhaps hold an ample amount of cash where psychologically you will be able to deal with a 30% drawdown in your resource portfolio, you know, if we do see a broader market wipeout. That's definitely within the realms of possibility. In terms of, you know, security selection, maybe investors would feel more comfortable, you know, buying companies that have large cash and marketable security positions relative to market cap. You know, we're buying prospect generators as we speak. In one case, 65% of its of and this is going to be the upcoming featured investment. I won't name it on this podcast, but 65% of the market caps covered by cash and marketable securities. And then a name that I've mentioned on a previous KE report interview, Almadex Minerals. You know, you can buy that company at below its cash breakup value as it stands. And so as an investor, that gives me comfort, you know, where your average junior could fall 90-95% before it reaches its cash breakup value. There are names out there if you sort through the mess where there's very defined downside, you know, before you're trading below liquidation value. So that's one thing to look at. And additionally, if you're scared of market conditions for the rest of next year, and for the rest of this year, and if you want to be conservative for the rest of next year, maybe look at companies that don't have to raise capital for the foreseeable future. They either have, you know, huge cash positions in the bank. You know, one example is Bravo Mining. That's a company that I featured in the most recent MJG investor letter. You know, they had $25 million in the bank, and they just raised another $25 million. So this is a company that can go through the end of 2024 and maybe quite a bit longer without raising additional capital. If you can wait out tough markets without being forced to dilute, that gives me a lot more confidence as an investor. So yeah, those would be the 3 tips: ample cash, perhaps focus on, you know, opportunities with defined downside protection, where if things don't go to plan, you're not going to lose 90% of your capital. And additionally, perhaps look for stories that for one reason or another will not have to raise capital for the next 12, 18 months.
All right. Well, it still sounds kind of like playing in the defense of angle too, right? Now is not the time to get overly aggressive, but look, pay attention to those companies with cash, as you said. Limit your downside risk and keep some cash on the sidelines. Matt, it's always interesting to hear what you're doing within the MJG Capital portfolio and fund. And thanks for taking a little look at the nickel market for us, because there has been a bit more interest in the nickel market, and there are still some companies out there that are attractive. So, hey, something that I'm sure we'll follow up on future calls. I do appreciate your time this weekend. Everybody, thanks for tuning in with us this weekend. Please visit our website and podcast to listen to all the daily editorials and company updates we recorded throughout the week. Everybody, thanks for tuning in this weekend. Matt, again, thank you very much for your time.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.